Dear Lord, cool the heats of our desires, that we may hear your word. In Christ we ask it. Amen. When I was 14, at a church camp, I had a very powerful spiritual experience. I became an atheist. It was a serious matter for me, and it lasted just about 6 years. In the year that I would turn 20, I had another. I was writing a manifesto against religion for a college course called The Psychology of Religion. I thought I had my mitts on the basic themes that would explain all religion away. But I had been dared to study Paul Tillich by a friend. I was engaged in a course, and every week I spent in the seminar up at the Divinity School that I would later attend as a matriculant. Every week caused me to go back to my manifesto and erase pages and scratch it through and rework it. My theory of atheism was falling apart under the intellectual light and the spiritual depth of Paul Tillich. On a certain morning in April, lilac fragrance wafting through the window of my study, the whole thing fell apart. I suddenly sensed this object that I had been studying, which I called world religion, was really none other than myself. And I was really only looking at myself, a tight little ball of needs and hopes, that I knew nothing of religion, and that somehow this little ball was sustained by an infinite presence. I guessed that this was the name people give God. And I was humbled. And my atheism ended, though my Christianity did not start then. But here is why I tell this story of a spiritual rest, of a vision in the morning. Like Jacob in the story that we heard last Sunday, whose God touched him deep in a wilderness, who gave him a vision of light, who gave him rest from his labors. My youthful access to the world of spirit did not at all keep me from having a hot, confused, difficult, and costly first adulthood. It was no protection whatsoever. Now, I don't mean that I became a personality unrecognizably unlike the man you now see, but I do mean that if my first adulthood was a car, when I got the keys, I ran the red lights with it, I hit and I got hit, I didn't change the oil, I had a couple of trannies, I ran out of gas in rough neighborhoods, I didn't know where I was going. You get the idea. You just heard the idea in Jacob's dream. God had confirmed in Jacob's dream that we read last week, God had confirmed him in utmost security and purposiveness. Confirmed was he. And it was all told in a few sentences, but now spread over 3 long chapters, Jacob is jaded, jumping, jiving, striving, surviving, scheming, dreaming of girls and making money and making babies and going home and double dealing with his uncle and his uncle him. Oh, in parts that we leapt over just to keep our time in check. Rachel and Leah get hip deep in this mess. They are all elbows and aggression and jealousy one for the other, full of sex and subterfuge. Go home and read this whole thing. Chapter 29 to 31, it's twice as long as what you heard this morning at least. You will come away breathless. Jacob earns his name. Remember what it means? He supplants, he schemes, he cheats, he lies, he flees. And his uncle Laban joins with him in what we might call the olden rule. Do unto others before they do unto you. Where is that memorable moment, that deep inward stillness in the wilderness? In answer, I have only to think of myself also at the age of 20, and really of any young adult. For man or for woman, though our patterns differ markedly, first, adulthood is a fever. It's a fever. It is unforeseen by any of the distresses of youth, and it lasts many, many years. Genesis has these strangely long stretches of stories, 3 chapters, and they send to us a peculiar task this morning, to find a spiritual meaning for an unspiritual life. In these 3,000 words of storytelling, the name of God appears fewer than 20 times, and mostly it's in the mouth of Jacob or one of the other personages as a boast that God is on my side, giving me wealth, giving me babies, giving me protection from my enemies. But God, God's self, does not appear in these stories, not until the very end. So let's ask about an unspiritual life and do so with a spiritual purpose. What is unspiritual? It's a phrase that the Apostle Paul uses. Well, let's back off. What is spiritual? That's a word freighted heavily in our culture. Many people use it. They mean many things with it. So many say, I am spiritual, but not religious. I think this, at least, may be held in common by all who use the word spiritual. That a person sometimes feels conscious of her being in the presence of a good reality extended infinitely beyond herself. I had a spiritual experience there at the age of 20. So if that is spiritual, an experience of good reality extending infinitely beyond oneself, transcending, is the philosopher's word. Well, then we would know what unspiritual life is. It refers to life when we are usually only aware of what seems to us not beyond ourself, but within our grasp, aware of what we possess and what we want to possess, our skills, our drives, our things, including people sometimes, our ambitions, our fears, to be aware only of these. This is an unspiritual life. Perhaps Jacob in his first adulthood was a kind father, perhaps an attentive lover and a good husband, though he had 4 women to attend to, that's tough. But with all, Jacob in these stories is an unspiritual man. And he remains so for 20 years. Carl Jung would say, yes, yes, that's about right. This is the Genesis story. What can be the spiritual purpose of giving 3 chapters to an unspiritual man? I wish we might think of this as a kind of a blessing and a kind of a warning. The blessing is this, that the confusion and torment and the erotic and creative drives of first adulthood have been observed by our spiritual ancestors without judgment. That's powerful. That's a kind of blessing. This means that perhaps your grandparents have observed you, if not your parents, without judgment. That they remember what it was like to drive that car. They've seen it all, they remember. And their acceptance involves this additional insight. We would not be here, not one of us, says the Genesis story, we would not be here except for this rough passage of first adulthood. When we wrestle bread, as Genesis 3 has it, wrestled bread from the sweat of our face and babies from our bodies. When we tossed and argued for love and money, sometimes week in and week out for years. Like Jacob and Rachel, like Leah and Laban, we are. And we wouldn't be here if that was not part of the human story. It's all here. It's set down. They saw it. No judgment. Yeah. Yeah. Jews today live in this blessing with a great deal more freedom than Christians do. But we were wise enough to include the Old Testament in our Bible. An awful lot of my colleagues never preach from the Hebrew Bible. I find the cross of Christ visible in so many ways here. It is part of Israel's blessing on all the earth to speak these stories. And now, here in these long tales from chapters 29 to 31, the question drawn like a sword at the neck of the tribe of Israel since chapter 12. That question which we phrased a week or two ago this way, we are old and famished and few, hating our kin and besieged by enemies. Will we make it out of here now with Jacob's 11 sons? There's a 12th to be born. With Jacob's 11, the answer is in. Yes, by the force of life, we became as many as the stars of the night. But there is a warning in this story. Laban's parting kiss on the foreheads of his grandchildren is by no means the end of the story. It's just the end of chapter 31. Where this story is going, we're not going to get to today. Which makes this sermon sort of odd to find a spiritual meaning for an unspiritual life. But where it is going, come back next Sunday or the one after, I guess, and find out. Where it is going proves that the tales are offered in warning also. The warning is this: the unspiritual life is a deep, long sleep. It is a kind of waking unconsciousness. The Quran notes this with the following in Surah 2. Do you think that you shall enter the garden of bliss without such trials as came to those who passed away before you? And James, we heard James speak to this. My brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of any kind, consider it nothing but joy, because you know that the testing of your faith produces endurance. This is the spirit of the warning of Genesis. Hear ye, all who seek safe passage from birth to death, for all who are in your care, hear ye. The sober word in these stories, it is hard to hear when you are in your first adulthood, and it is hard to watch when you are emerging from it. But the word is, presently, you must wake up from the unspiritual life, lest your life be swallowed up in misery. You must wake up. Signs of the deep sleep of the unconscious adulthood appear everywhere around us. Its major chord is that one-dimensional self-certainty that seems so often to attach itself to a certain kind of public figure. Carl Jung wrote of the first adulthood in these terms: the nearer we approach to the middle of life, the better we have succeeded in entrenching ourselves in our personal standpoints and social positions, and so the more it appears as if we had discovered the right course and the right principles of behavior. We wholly overlooked the essential fact that the achievements which society rewards us with are won at the cost of a diminished personality. That is what we so often see in public life, diminished personalities. Life seems not just there, but we encounter this all the time. To some people, life seems deadly serious. They are utterly humanless people. Getting to the goal matters most. It seems that no happiness is possible unless I get my way or the highway, my way, dead or alive, bring them on. You go to war knowing nothing. You send men to torture others knowing nothing. You Glengarry Ross like Jacob. You drive the world economy into a swamp with games of chance that ramp your ego. You let media, those weapons of mass distraction, have your whole gaze. Every action you cause makes another react to you, and you stand in shock, the world's first victim, preparing to get back at that person who initiated the first crime in all history against you, telling yourself, you know how to drive this car. This is the character of the first adulthood. Carl Jung expected to see manifestations of the first adulthood well into our 40s. I don't know about you, I was there. It is a kind of deep unconsciousness before the true self wakes. It is peculiar to look back. In a little book about emerging from these miseries, James Hollis writes, reviewing one's life from the vantage point of the second half requires understanding and forgiveness of the inevitable crime of unconsciousness. It was a time when we did not realize that there was a straightforward trade to be made in negotiating our life with humans. It goes like this. You can either be in the right or in relationship. As one increases, the other decreases. This is a spiritual law. You can either be in the right or in relationship. Choose. The unspiritual man is very clear about the choice. The spiritual man and woman have begun to wake up to relationship. I have a good friend in Buffalo who was in prison many years. He lived with me for a time. He said to me once, all crime is caused by pain not dealt with. I think Carl Jung would have said, oh master, teach me. All crime. Jacob was a criminal in that sense. I was a criminal in that sense. When I first began going into the prison at Attica many years ago, as I listened to the motivations driving, having driven the men in prior younger years, I thought, I'm a criminal. We are all criminals. To be sure, the state has no interest in mine, and that is as it must be. But how extraordinary when one sees in oneself no distinction between others sorely treated by society. And so, this inward requirement of waking up, a spiritual and psychic awakening, a requirement of authenticity, brings a man, a woman, out of a long sleep. It is not easy. It is not comfortable. It is not quite our story today, because Jacob is not awake when this story ends. But even when we do wake, the warning of Genesis goes with us always. For never again do we think of ourselves as the top of judgment, as one who has learned, as one who thinks others inferior. No, we learn that every round goes higher and higher, and that we will stumble and need help to wake again. It is the way of the cross. It is the reason that the great tradition has always seen in Jacob's ladder a symbol of the cross, a way in which the angel of heaven comes up and down from earth to heaven. It is a rough passage to get there. What has this to do with the church in general? Perhaps it is only personal. I think not, though. I'd say a church also has a life cycle, not necessarily one on earth like humans do, sometimes more like the roller coaster, not always holy. Many churches pass away altogether. They fail to be reborn in their time. However that may be, let us think for a moment about this question of the unspiritual and the spiritual life as it pertains to a particular community. A healthy spiritual community embraces the whole of life, has no preference to try to keep one kind of vision and being, one kind of drive, one kind of wisdom out in exchange for another. But many churches do miss the Genesis balance, which keeps the elders who have waked clearly visible and strong in their voice of love. For those who have waked into their true self do not need to have their way. That is a primary sign of having waked or begun to wake up, is that we lose the need to have our way. I first learned the rule from a great psychotherapist in Albany, New York, in 1984. When she said to me, Steve, never defend yourself. But I did not learn how to apply that rule when I was that young. It took many years. And I remember the first time I was in a contentious situation in a different church, in a church as its pastor many, many years later. And I was at last ready, having come through a rough passage, to not defend myself in a moment of contention. Such a blessing it is to be able to give one's ear and presence in the situation of hurt and uncertainty. A church that is going to wake up to a new possibility embraces the way of the cross, the way of no defending, the way of standing clearly for what it knows, for love itself. The Genesis balance accepts the whole and is able to give power to young people. This is an area of discovery for the Riverside Church, how to share power with young men and women. It is the implied message of the Genesis stories. James, we listen to him one time more. My brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of any kind, consider it nothing but joy, because you know that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And so I leave you with a little poem. When I first met it, it was not attributed to anyone. Now I think a Portia Nelson is said to be the poet. Autobiography, some of you know this. Autobiography in 5 short chapters. I walk down the street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I am lost. I am helpless. It isn't my fault. It takes forever to find a way out. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I am in the same place, but it isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it is there. I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. I leave you with chapter 5. The chapter for the Riverside Church. I walk down another street. Amen.